Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And our artist this week is Amanda Cobbett of Embroidered Nature. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Gary.
Thanks for joining us here. And this show is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. And here is a word from Kim.
This edition of Fiber Talk is proudly sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant young needlework shop located on the picturesque Main Street of Weaverville, North Carolina. We hope you find a way to come visit us soon. If you can't make it to us, then visit us on Facebook or Instagram. We love it when you stop by and say hi, whether it's in person or online. Many heartfelt thanks to everyone who stitched our free download, Aussie Friends. We are overwhelmed by how many of you have taken the time to stitch and post this sweet little benefit for fire recovery in Australia. Please feel free to share this design with anyone you like, including guilds and stitch groups. We'll be tallying up all the posted and emailed finishes through February 29th to determine our contribution to two Australian charities working on fire recovery. Every stitch counts, and we so appreciate all of your positive energy, thoughts, and prayers going to everyone and every animal impacted by these horrific wildfires. Thank you for stitching with us to support our Aussie friends. If you haven't signed up for our winter online class module, Learning Stitches, please join us as we're just getting rolling. You can find the info on our homepage at sassyjackstitchery.com. We'd love to have you join us on this first of many fun and affordable online workshops. We truly appreciate you, and we really appreciate all the good things we hear and learn from Fiber Talk. We are super proud to be a sponsor of this wonderful resource of stitching goodness. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for giving us some stabby pokey talk twice a week. Kim and team at Sassy Jack Stitchery.
Thanks, Kim, and please support all of our sponsors. They're who make this thing possible. And Amanda, now this is going to be a different Fiber Talk podcast because it's not traditional needle thread and ground cloth. Amanda does amazing things with a sewing machine and thread and paper mache, making mushrooms and lichens and all kinds of nature-based art. And I have to say, Amanda, I am really excited. I've been wanting to get to you for some time now because I used to do a lot of photography. I wish I did more of it now. But my favorite kind of photography is nature, macro, and getting close. So, like, I take a picture of a flower. I don't take a picture of a flower. I take a picture of part of the flower. And when I saw your work, it was like, oh, you're singing my song. That up close, the little tiny things in nature that you find, fascinating stuff. What brings you to do that? What is it that, I mean, you get right down in there close. It's so much fun to watch what you get out of that.
Where do I start? I've always been interested in nature, even, you know, as a small child. I used to collect all sorts of things. I think I probably lived in my own little fantasy world because I didn't have any sisters to play with. I've just got two brothers. And I think I had to make my own fun. So I would spend a lot of time outside. I think my parents used to probably encourage us to go outside and play. And we lived under this lovely big old oak tree. And I used to collect acorns every autumn and make little pixie cups. And I was interested in everything that was a miniature, you know, my doll's house, everything that I could, you know, look at the detail of. That's what I was really interested in. And I suppose because that's always been an interest, there was a natural progression into studying detail.
Yeah, see, I relate so closely to that because that's what I do, just everything. I always want to get in to the minute details and see the texture and you know, the subtleties rather than the bigger picture. And to me, that's where fun is at.
I think a lot of people forget about that because they're very so busy looking at the bigger picture that they sometimes neglect the detail. But that's always been the thing that's interested me. And to be able to now use it with my work is an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, you win on that account, no doubt about it. Yes.
Thank you.
Now, did in your early years, an artist, biologist, science, what orientation did you start from?
No, I've always been encouraged to do art and to be creative. Both my grandparents or my grandmothers, should I say, were both needleworkers, and my mother is very good on the sewing machine. But they taught me the things that you teach a kid in the 70s. It was a traditional childhood where every child probably sewed, or every girl sewed. I know that's not the case these days, but I think in the as a typical 70s child, that was something that I enjoyed watching my grandmothers and my mother do. And I never realized textiles featured quite so much in my life until they did, if that makes sense. So learning to sew from them, and then going to college, I always actually thought I was going to be a photographer. I had no even comprehension or conception of what somebody who worked in textiles did. I don't think I even knew that there was such a job. I mean, I knew people made clothes, but I didn't realize that I could make a job out of it. I was at art college doing a foundation, because in the UK you go through your school education and then you do a foundation year if you want to go into art college. And that foundation year, you try a bit of everything. So I'd tried photography, I'd tried sculpture, I'd tried some textiles, some woodwork, some metalwork, a number of different things. But it was I always came back to the fabric, as much as I enjoyed doing all those other things. And in fact, during my A levels, I have an A level in sculpture, which I'm very proud of. And I think I always loved making things in three dimension, and textiles was another way of being able to do that. I suppose you might assume that if you're doing something with textiles or fiber art, that it might be two dimensional. But for me, it's always been a three dimensional. It's always been about the three dimension, and it's been a combination of adding texture and form. But actually, when I started my career, I didn't start out as doing what I do now. And in fact, I graduated as a printed textile designer, and of course that's very flat. And my
Yes,
world
as a rule,
just
yes.
remained flat. Yes, it remained flat for about, I don't know, 10, 12 years, until I got to saturation point. And it was really then that I thought, okay, I need to, as much as I love designing, and I still use that design aspect when I'm creating a piece of work, I just needed to be able to make something. And that's always been the physical side of actually being able to make something is really important.
Yeah, well, that textile designing, printed textile designing, I mean, that's its own art form. There's at some point there's a challenge to that, but I can see after a while, you go, okay, how many patterns can I put together?
I mean, after doing that for several years, and in fact, there was a team of us that used to work freelance for a company, but I was always the floral designer. And I must have designed hundreds and hundreds of florals in hundreds of different ways. And actually, that makes me quite picky about wearing clothing now, because I know how well or how badly a floral has been designed.
It's a curse.
So it really is. It is a curse, actually. And in fact, for a while, I hated florals. That just shows you how much I did of it, and got so completely saturated by it that I just thought, okay, I don't need to do this anymore. I've enjoyed it at the time, but I just don't need to do it anymore.
We'll never see Amanda in a flowered blouse ever.
No, very rarely. I do love print. But I'm very picky about the prints that I choose to wear, because I know whether they've been well designed or not.
Yeah.
And also color plays a massive part in that as well. But everybody knows what they like and what they don't like, I suppose. But yeah, I can definitely tell in the shops a bad design, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I know that feeling because I'm a magazine editor, and the printed word, reading novels or anything, it's the same curse. I find everything. Why didn't you write the sentence this way? Or how could you miss this typo? And yeah, it just
I mean, there's a million different ways to do something, I suppose. But each to their own, I guess. Some people will never notice those things, but if you're looking at it day in, day out, unfortunately, you do start to notice those things.
Yeah, it won't leave you alone, I guarantee you. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had sewing from your grandmother and mother, and art, and textiles, and ended up doing flowers. So that all really just kind of came together to make what you do now.
Yeah, I kind of feel that everything that's happened in the past has led me to where I am now. When I was studying for my degree, I was really fortunate that my course, one of the course leaders, was a textile floral designer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And she really encouraged me to sort of perfect the art, I suppose. And she introduced me to some beautiful botanical illustrations that we went to look at the Natural History Museum in London. And I was allowed a library pass so I could go and look whenever I wanted. And they are beautiful colour plate illustrations. The first ones that she showed us, or that we went to see, were from Cook's first voyage. Mm. So they're utterly beautiful. And then I also had the library pass allowed me access to Kew Botanical Garden. So I was sort of got the backstage pass to Kew, and could go and look at any number of things there. So it sort of sparked my interest in the botanical more than ever, I suppose. When you're textile designing, print designing, you can't always, you know, use that information, that reference material, because firstly, there's no time. And secondly, it's just not relevant for what I'm doing. But at the moment, the things that I do now, I can go back to all those resources. And they're only too pleased to have someone who's got an interest to go and, you know, use their library and their resources, because mm-hmm. that's really what it's there for. It's research.
Right. So I can see the wires connecting now. You get botanical garden and mm-hmm. beautiful plates. And yeah, I can see your mind starting to put that together and say, wait a minute, I can create something out of this.
Yeah. It's almost like how can you make something that you can find look real? Because really that's what botanical artists were doing, and there was no use of photography, so they had to record the information. So I suppose in a way that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to record the information that I'm seeing when I'm on my dog walk in the woods, or if I'm, you know, going to do some research somewhere, particularly for a certain type of lichen or fungi. So, this is my way of recording information.
So how do we get started on that? What's the first piece? What's the mental process that gets you started on making the kinds of things you do today? I'm sure the early ones were fascinating little efforts.
Well, it took the early ones took quite a long time. I think, oh, I'm really, you know, it was taking me a month to make one case full of mushrooms, and I was quite pleased with myself. Whereas today, you know, if it was, I'd never be successful if it was taking me that long. But the start of the process really is a walk, to take a walk, to sort of clear my mind, to to see what I can find. And having a dog makes you do that because you have no choice. You have to walk.
Yes.
And so Frank, my dog, and I go out on a dog walk and go out on a walk rather. And he bumbles along, and I either walk to solve a problem or walk to look for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm walking to solve a problem, I walk quite quickly, and I'm just enjoying being in the forest, being immersed in the wood that's directly opposite my house. If I'm walking to look, then obviously it's a much slower walk. And it's usually in the afternoon I'm looking for something interesting. And it can be anything. Anything can spark it. It could be, you know, based on colour, on texture, or something that I haven't seen before. There's various lichens that are popping up all the time. I confess I don't know all the scientific names for all of them. I have to bring them home and look them up and try and work out if that's what I'm looking at, and you know what I've got before me is right. What I can find in my reference.
Yeah. But it's fungi, also fungi are not easy either. So I admire the fact that you were slapping scientific names on those, because they're not easy at all.
Yeah, no, they're not. But over the years, I've sort of got to know what I can find and where, and it's quite interesting year on year when you look in the same places as to what you see and the time of year you see it and what the crop is like, because sometimes you might see one or two and another year there'll be hundreds, and mm-hmm. then another year there won't be any. So it's quite interesting to also record that information on what's growing where and at what time of year. And I do that. I record all the information on my phone. So I take a photograph of what I see. I then take a grid reference of where I found it. And that obviously the photograph has the date and the time, I think, on it as well. So it's quite interesting that you can, you know, modern technology allows you to be able to do that. Whereas, you know, on Cook's first voyage, you're relying totally on their ability to be able to make an accurate representation by drawing it,
right.
and using the right colours, and trusting that the colours that they've got there, they're perhaps, you know, fairly primitive colour palette, are right. The colours that you're seeing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, today I could maybe photograph a fungi one day, and then the following day that might have degraded a little bit, or, you know, the following year one year it might be brighter than another year. It just depends. But that in itself is quite interesting. So when I'm making my work, I'm trying to represent those facts as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's just it. And for most mushrooms, their life cycle is so short that you could catch it at any point and not know if that's its peak or not.
No, I mean, you do, I suppose, like, you do get to know, now that I've done it for, you know, six years, you kind of get to know when you think, oh, and I'm walking every day, so I might pass that every day, and I might even photograph that specimen maybe 3, 4, 5 times as it starts to degrade. And actually, sometimes it becomes a bit more interesting when it's not perfect. Because that's nature. You want to see the imperfections as well.
Yeah, that was something I wanted to explore with you, because in my photography, oftentimes what's most interesting is not when whatever the subject is at its peak. It's before or after, or maybe after it's long dead. It makes interesting.
Yeah, there's a mushroom that I find in the woods called a shaggy ink cap. I don't know if you have them in America, but we have quite a few here in our wood, and as they emerge, they're sort of like a shaggy white tube. They're quite long, quite long cone shaped mushrooms. And then when they as they start to spread out and get a bit more shaggy, the tops of them change quite dramatically, and then underneath they're quite dark, you know, it's a sort of black and white contrast. Mm-hmm. And they get quite big, but over a number of days, and then suddenly, you know, you go the next day and they're completely gone, you know, no sign, completely gone.
Yeah.
But watching that cycle is really, really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, to me that's really the interesting part, is how they process through and become so different from when they start. Yeah. That makes it fun.
So
yeah.
when I'm making my work, quite often I might show different stages. I might make three of the same thing, but in different stages, just so you can see that they don't, because if you go out and think, oh, that's how they always look all the time, then you'd be mistaken,
right,
because they're changing the whole time. Right. So I quite like to be able to, and sometimes in my cases, I might have three of the same specimen. So I might have three shaggy ink caps, say, but in various stages of along their life cycle, mm-hmm. just to show you how, you know, the progression.
Yeah. When I was a wise photographer taught me, when you approach a scene, to first photograph the scene so that at least you've recorded whatever the scene is.
Mm-hmm.
But then just stand there and absorb it. And that's when the real photos show up. Does that happen to you when you walk up to an area?
Yeah, it definitely does. I'm quite often seen just standing around. I'm sure there are people that walk past me in the wood thinking, oh, God, there she is. Or what the hell is she doing? Yeah, I am quite often just standing around. I just like to absorb the moment, you know, especially even like today, the weather was really wild. And most people are hurrying along and want to get out of the rain. But I just want to. Sometimes it is just good just to stand and watch the trees, see what's happening. On a frosty day, just to look at how the forest sparkles, and just little things like that make life magical.
Right.
I'm still living in my little fairy world, probably, that I was in when I was a little girl.
Yeah, but it's at those moments when you just stop and let it soak into you, that then the things, to me at least, they start to pop out. Oh, I've never seen this over here, or I've never seen this in this way.
Yeah.
And that's when it really comes to life for me.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, when especially the fungi that are brightly colored, because actually when you can really look at the detail, and then when you stand back, you think, how, why is this is something bright red or purple that's just, it's just there. Who's noticed? Who's actually noticed that you're mm-hmm. there? When you zone back out and look at the bigger picture, it's that sudden little pop of red in the corner of your eye that almost shouldn't be, well, it should be there, but it's like a little jewel, my little jewels in the forest.
Right, yeah. So then when you're on these walks, then you actually collect specimens?
Well, most of the fungi I photograph, because firstly, some of them are very poisonous.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is what are you doing
so
about that?
So I've kind of got to know, and I'm really careful. I always wash my hands when I come in if I have been touching anything, because it's okay to touch them. It's just not okay then to put your hands in your mouth.
Right.
So, so a lot of them I photograph. I rarely pick them unless it's something I really don't know. And I think, right, okay, I could take that back and look it up, but I can usually work from photographs, and I go out there a lot. So I'm looking and observing because that's mainly what it's about. Making my work is about observation. So, and I obviously I can't stitch in the field or do anything, and I don't take a sketchbook to draw because I suppose I feel I don't need to. So yeah, just from my daily observations, and then I would have a photograph to remind me of how that looked. Yes, but in terms of the lichen and the bark and the mosses, I don't take mosses from the forest because you're not actually allowed to do that. But what I can do is take fallen bits of, you know, sort of debris on the from the forest floor. So if a piece of bark has fallen off a tree and it's laying on the ground, then I would take it back and then I can work directly like that.
Right.
And they do dry out, but they don't degrade quite as quickly as, you know, a mushroom or fungi is going to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just wondered about that because, yeah, you could go through a forest and just take specimens all day long and upset the ecosystem to some degree. And you don't
Yeah. And in fact, I get slightly tetchy when I see, I never say anything, but I can feel myself going, oh, don't take them all when I see people foraging. Yeah, because there's a way to, there's a law, there's a foraging law. And I think some enthusiastic people don't know what the foraging rules are.
Right.
And you shouldn't actually pick a fungi up with its root attached. You should actually cut them off. Yeah. But I think a lot of people don't do that. And in fact, you know, when I'm making them, I'm trying to show the roots as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to use I'm using reference books to look at roots and things because I feel that, you know, obviously my photographs aren't going to show that.
Right.
So I am having to use good reference books as well to show how they would look if they were plucked out of the ground. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I take them out if I know there's lots of them there, but I certainly wouldn't decimate a wood with from one species because you just can't do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So this woods that is across from your home, does that give you pretty much all you need, or do you find yourself getting in the car and going other places?
Well, if I'm invited to other places, to other woods, then I definitely go. The wood is big enough for me to keep me busy for a very long time. However, just recently I was invited up to Yorkshire because I'm doing a project with the North Yorkshire Moors National Park, and I've just finished doing some research up there because obviously the things that they have there are quite different to what I have in the south of England. That said, there are obviously things that I can see there, which I can also see here. However, they are, you know, here it's slightly warmer. I know it's only 200-300 miles away, 200 miles away. However, it's cold and uncompromising in Yorkshire in the winter. And so what's growing there is much smaller and much brighter than perhaps I can see in my own wood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite interesting to make that comparison. And there are things on the moors and in sort of fen and bog that especially the mosses that I don't see them in my own wood. I mean, I'm here with beech and oak and pine and fir. So and that's quite different to where I was doing my research a couple of weeks ago that have a lot of alder alder and elder actually, which I don't see so much of here. So mm-hmm. It's quite interesting. I mean, that's, you know, it's quite interesting to go and see what lichen grows on each different tree. And in fact, a couple of years ago, Sarah and I did a research trip in Scotland, and the lichen that grows there is phenomenal. It's beautiful. And we certainly don't have the specimens that we found down here. And I don't know if you know, lichen is an indication of how clean your air is.
No, I did not know that. Educate me.
Well, the more lichen on a tree is a good indicator of how clean your air is. So as an example, if you were to go to a city...
More is cleaner air then.
Yeah. So you go up to Scotland, up to the Highlands, and you know you've got beautifully clean air if you can find trees that are laden with lichen. And it's the same. I go to the Alps, the French Alps, every year to walk. The trees up, you know, in the alpine forests are beautiful because they are laden with these fantastic lichens and mosses that that just don't grow in the same way. And it's about altitude and as well. But what you see is almost like supersized to some of the things that we can see here, where the air quality perhaps isn't as good.
Mm-hmm. See, that was when I first saw your work. That was one of the things that popped into my head, is the amazing things, the subtle differences, and extreme differences that you must see in doing this kind of work, because it just 100 miles can make such a huge difference.
Yeah, that's right. And it's about getting your eye in as well, because you wouldn't even think, I took my friend to Yorkshire with me, and that was her first reaction, was that she wouldn't even think to look mm-hmm. for something different. Whereas, you know, I suppose it's an interest of mine and I am looking all the time, so the things you see in one place certainly aren't the things that you're going to see elsewhere. Or if they are, they might be, like I say, different size or slightly different color because of the quality of the air.
Yeah. All right. So let's take your typical mushroom. Take me through the process, the learning process of creating the art. That must have been quite a process, I think.
Well, there was a lot of experimentation as to, you know, how the devil was I going to even start making this. And I think mushrooms and fungi have always held a fascination because they are so completely unusual. And, you know, they're neither, you know, they're not an animal form, then they're not a botanical thing, that, you know, they are a species of their own and more related to animal than they are plant. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just completely fascinating. So sitting here in my little studio thinking, how will I make this? How can I make something that obviously isn't real? Because how could it be? Because most people know that as soon as you've picked a mushroom, that it will degrade fairly quickly. And some of them, you know, within some of the tiny ones that you see in the forest, within half an hour of you picking them, then they would have wilted. Mm-hmm. And I did do a little bit of experimentation in the early days of, let me see what happens to that. If I pick that, what will happen to it? And then being very disappointed within, you know, half an hour of looking at it, thinking, oh, that's a little bit disappointing now because that's very shriveled up. But the idea that you could make something appear to be real, but not real, and try to trick the eye was to, and also to work out a way of using the materials that I had available to me. You know, my background's textiles. So that was my first thought. How could I make something in textiles that could be perceived as something that's serious and not, you know, that I could, people could look at and think, now, what am I looking at? Am I looking at something that's real or made? So paper and thread are my two main materials, and paper is great for a number of reasons because it's so versatile. And I use so to make my mushrooms, for example, I'm using a paper mache to make the stem, and that's great for support. And it's such a solid material. Once you've added some size to paper to stick it, it then becomes like a lighter version of wood again, because you've made it so solid. And mm-hmm. then you can once it's solid, and I make a solid tube for the stems of the mushrooms, and then once they're completely dry, I can then carve them with a knife.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I learned to do that over time, because, you know, I didn't really have any carving skills. However, now I've sort of learned that in order to get the shapes that I want, because they're not all straight up and down, I have to be able, you know, I had to work out a way of being able to do that. So once the stem is completely dry, I'm then using a knife to carve it and then sanding it down, like with sandpaper and wet and dry paper, which is like a glass paper.
That helps me understand. Yeah, that's what I was trying to understand, because if the stems have mm-hmm. a bulbous portion to them, you're yeah. delivering that. So that's how you're doing that, is yeah. taking a straight tube yeah. and then and forming it.
Yes, yeah. So I'm adding just little layers each time, just adding layers and layers of paper and then drying it. And then when it's completely solid, and they really are, I mean, they're sort of invincible. If I was to drop one of my sculptures on the floor, nothing would happen to it. It's not going to get damaged mm-hmm. because they're solid little things. They don't, you know, the good thing about paper is that it's not going to crack, and it's right. and it's not really going to dent it either. And actually it wouldn't really matter even if it did, but it doesn't. So the stem is the support, really, as it is on a regular mushroom fungi. And then I had to work out a way of then making the caps, the mushroom caps. And that's where my sewing, my machine embroidery technique then came in. And I've said before to other people that I'm not an embroiderer. I didn't train in embroidery. I knew nothing about embroidery before I started doing this. And my mother-in-law's friend had a sewing machine that was practically gifted to me. And my mother-in-law is an embroiderer, machine and hand embroiderer. And her friend Brenda is also does both, and they were very kind, and they were very supportive to me, or they still are, and showed me a few techniques. And at first I wasn't even making any of this stuff. I was thinking, I was given the machine and I was thinking, oh, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do? What am I going to make? How am I going to use this machine? And then it was sort of then limitless, because I have no formal training. I sort of felt that there were no rules that I was suddenly going to be breaking. So I was just making up my own rules, and it's still like that. I'm still kind of making up my own rules, because that's the way it works for me. I'm just, you know, it's free motion embroidery. It's great fun. I can just clear my mind and just see what I can make. And it never really goes wrong, because there's nothing to go wrong with it. Right. But I have, in terms of, say, for instance, making mushroom caps, or making the some of the lichen, which is very, very intricate, I've had to sort of work out some little techniques of how to achieve that. And during my life as a printed textile designer, I also did a little bit of designing of homewares, which included tableware. And I used to have to make a print design that fitted around a breakfast bowl. So you're given in the old days before it was computerized, you were given the shape of the bowl, the pattern that needed to fit round the bowl. So you weren't given a bowl, you were just given the shape. Mm-hmm. So from that, the information that I had from that, I could work out, okay, so I now know how to make a bowl shape, which is similar to a mushroom cap. Uh-huh. Or a cone shape if I was making something else, you know, some other homeware that required it to be in a cone shape. So you kind of my relating or translating 2D to 3D was sort of my brain sort of could work out mm-hmm. how to sew a pattern and sew machine embroider in the right direction in order to make the right shape. And it's still trial and error, and I try lots of different things all the time, but I kind of know now how to construct something using thread. And it's sewing thread onto a dissolvable fabric, which I use two different types. One is a very soft and it looks like a bonded fabric, and another one looks more like a plastic fabric. They're both dissolvable in warm water and, you know, they're safe to use.
Yeah.
I know that the plastic type one is like an algae based fabric. Okay. I don't know if you've ever used them.
No. When I saw that on the video on your website, it looked like you were stitching on cling wrap, saran wrap.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. Yeah. And it's absolutely not that at all. So that washes, that completely washes away. And then it just leaves you with your thread. But obviously, you know, as any embroiderer will tell you, that if you're doing this kind of embroidery, that you have to lock over your stitches, otherwise you're going to end up with just one big mess.
Right.
So you kind of need to work it through a bit in your mind how you're going to not make it all fall apart. but that kind of happened quite quickly. You know, I managed to work it out.
Yeah, that was my thought as I was watching the process in the video. How does she know that all these threads are connected? So when you wash away the dissolvable fabric, that it's going to hold together. That had to been, must have been many a time when it just came all apart.
Yeah, there have been times when I've washed things and thought, oh, how am I going to get this back together again? But actually, you can dry it and then you can sandwich it again between two layers of dissolvable fabric, so everything is recoverable. Mm-hmm. Because even if you end up with a mess, you can still sort of cut it or work out how to just keep working on it. So I never feel like I've had a failed attempt at something, because something can always be reused. You know, I quite often sit here in an evening and sew a load of roots and dirt. You know, and I think, oh, how many other people are sewing dirt tonight? I might be the only one.
I think you are, yes.
but that's quite relaxing process, because there's no, you know, I could just sew in any direction, because I know that when I wash it away, it's going to look a real mess. But that doesn't matter, because that's what dirt and humus and all the things that are in the soil, that's basically what it is. So it kind of works. I can work it out usually. And that, you know, I've now got to the stage where I don't make, well, I don't really feel like I've ever made a mistake. I've just learned along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. The other part that impressed me is I think most people would make the cap, but you worry about the underside too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So it's important for support as much as, you know, realism. And actually, you know, If you really start studying them, the underneath are either they're quite different. They're not all gills underneath each mushroom. Some have gills, others have paws with spines, and others just have paws. And they, when you look at the underside of those, they look like honeycomb underneath. And that's a sort of another interesting sewing technique, trying to make minute honeycomb, but actually making those give you a really good solid piece that I'm sort of recreating another my own fabric, I suppose, by layering and layering embroidery stitches. So it's an extra bit of support for the finished piece.
Now, are we using standard sewing thread or a mixture of threads? What are you using for that?
Well, I use all sorts. I love working with silk because I can use the very fine, the finest silk that I can find. And especially for making some of the lichens, that gives beautiful detail. So quite often with free machine embroidery, I think a lot of embroiderers like to use quite a heavyweight thread because you can get further quicker. Whereas I quite like to use the finest threads, which obviously take a lot longer, but give you better detail. But I would use, so on my extensive thread rack, I use superior threads, which I love, and they are a combination. I use the masterpiece ones because I love the colours and the nature colour ones, but they are either rayon, polyester, cotton, or silk. So, and I like to mix it up. Sometimes in the bobbin case, I would have a rayon thread. And then in the top, I might put a silk or a cotton, just because it just gives it a slightly different dimension. And especially if I'm using two different colours, that helps. It just makes it look less flat, I think, if you're trying to make something that's three dimensional.
Right.
If you've got different colours, then I don't know, it makes it look less flat.
Yeah. And then you must have to spend a good deal of time, just the subtlety of color throughout these pieces.
Yes. So I spend ages looking at and buying threads. And I would say I've probably got about 400 different ones, and that's still not enough. I still am looking for the ultimate colour sometimes. But also, when you're mixing two different colours together, by the time you've washed that out, you've got a new colour, really. So, I suppose it's a bit like mixing paint.
Yes.
I'm using it in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. So then you get this worked out, and you're able to now start producing these things. How do you get noticed? I mean, do you do an exhibit? What are you doing? Because somebody had to notice you somewhere along the way, I would think.
Well, it's been a progression. So I first started and I did a couple of trade fairs in the north of England. And from that, I had a few galleries that I then supplied to. And I also did some contemporary craft fairs. And so just to gauge reaction and see, who was interested in what and the price points that I could sell at. And it's always a good feeling if you know that you've taken 40 pieces to a show and almost sold them all.
Yes.
You kind of know that, okay, did I sell those too cheap or was that the right price point for that particular thing, or can I edge my prices up a bit more? So I suppose I spent the first three years trying to find the right market, and also feeling that I'm having been a commercial printed textile designer, I had to learn about whether this is profitable. It'll always be a hobby if you can't make money doing it. And for me, it was very much a lifestyle choice, but a career, hopefully, as much as as just a hobby, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with anything ever being a hobby unless you want to make money out of it. And it's quite difficult in a contemporary craft world to make that jump from, you know, am I just doing this part time and it's earning me a bit of extra pin money, or am I doing this seriously to earn money but still enjoy it?
That's the nexus right there, because so many people have ruined their hobbies trying to make money out of it. And finding that happy medium, that's tough.
But I think sometimes that happens because you then feel like you've got to go into mass production. Mm-hmm. And I've always said, okay, no mass production. I'm not taking on a team. I'm not, because that's not what I'm doing. That's not what it's about. It's about my work, and it's about how I feel about making something. So therefore I don't need it to go into mass production, because I don't need to make that much of it to make enough money.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, I've been strict and honest with myself about how much money I want to earn making these pieces. Yeah. So
you've been able to keep the art part as the dominant facet then.
Yeah. Because it's too easy to mass produce something and sell it for not enough money. And unfortunately, quite often with craft and contemporary craft, that's what happens. And it's not fair, because something might have taken you 3 hours to make and you're only charging, you know, $20 or £15 for it. Well, that's a ridiculous amount of money. You can never make it. You'd have to make a lot of those per hour to make that work. And that was never what it was about. So I've always made sure that everything that I make is what I should be charged for.
Yeah.
For what I'm charging for it. And I think quite often people, if they, you know, I hope that I'm bringing a skill and making a piece of work that is valued, you know, as a contemporary piece of art or craft, and I kind of feel like I waver between both, and I always feel like it sounds really pompous to say, oh, I'm an artist. I almost sort of like, oh, makes me not feel that comfortable. I just think, well, maybe I'm just a contemporary craftsperson.
No, it's art. See, that's and that's the thing. Of course, we deal with that in needlework of any kind, is that old question, is it craft, is it hobby, is it art? And, you know, at what point does it become art? And that was what stood out for me with your work, is that to me, it's just pure art, absolute art, because of how you're going about it. And yeah, you're imitating as close as you can nature, but to accomplish that takes art, takes skill. There's just so many dimensions to it that, yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that it's absolutely art and something to be proud of.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. You know, I think any needle craft just still gets a bad press.
Yes.
And it is such a shame that, you know, a once revered craft that was, you know, very well paid has fallen into the state that it is in a little bit now. And I kind of hope that what I'm doing will sort of redress that balance a little bit and say, you know, actually embroidery is an incredible art, and you know, and skill, although I'm not trained as an embroiderer, but there are so many incredible embroiderers out there.
Yes.
who do fantastic work, and I just hope that they are recognized for their skill. And I suppose my, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, my the business head on me says, in order to make this work, you have to be businesslike about it. And sometimes that's hard when you're a creative person to be able to to recognize that.
Right. Oh, yeah. Very, very hard. Because, yeah, it's you're not making it thinking, how many dollars can I get out of this? You're making it because you want to create something. And, I was doing needlepoint on an international flight one time a couple of years ago. And one of the flight attendants came up and said, "Ooh, do you sell those?" I said, "No, because you couldn't afford it."
No, it's true. You know,
the hours that
it's
go
in. It's true
because
somebody's not going to be, especially with quilting. There's so many hours worth of work in quilting and needlepoint. And you're right. People never would want to pay for the hours that had gone into the amount of work that it takes. And I still work long hours. You know, I'm certainly not knocking them out at speed. It's not how it works.
Yeah.
However, I have managed over the last 5 years to build up a reputation enough to still do an honest day's work. I'm not a millionaire. However, I'm still feel that I'm getting what I can make charge for the work is sort of justifying what it is. And actually having last year, having done Chelsea Flower Show, So it's like the world's biggest, or supposedly the world's biggest, flower and garden event. And I had a stand there, and I suppose that sort of suddenly sort of skyrocketed me to everybody wanting a piece of work. I've only recently from the show last May, I had to cap all my commissions because I just couldn't take on the amount of, I'd sold all the work and then couldn't take on all the commissions. So, which is great for me, but not so great for anybody else that's now waiting.
Right.
But I am only me, and I can only make so much, and I'm only prepared to make so much per year because I don't want it to be a production line. And I suppose that was my point earlier, that I want it to be a little bit exclusive because it keeps it precious, and you don't want to lose sight of what it is that you're doing.
Right. Well, and at some point you have to guard against burnout too. I mean, you could just completely just suck the life out of it, trying to make as many as possible to satisfy everyone.
Yeah. And I've done that. I've done that in the past and learned by those mistakes it can't work like that because it would just be hell.
Yes. Yes. And you mentioned commissions, and that was two other areas I wanted to look at was, and I guess you pretty much answered that question because it's such unique art, and the way you display it in those acrylic boxes is just so visually beautiful. I would think that you would get calls for commission, but then I also wonder, is there an element that is of interest to the scientific community, or how has that come up?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've had, having exhibited at Chelsea Flower Show and at, the RHS, I think it's their headquarters in London, and at Kew, it brings out the curious scientists as well, and I kind of that's sort of really thrilling when you meet specialists who are really loving it. And in fact, I did a little trip to New York in November last year, and I put something on Instagram saying, I'm doing a flying visit. Can anyone recommend some places that I might be able to, go and have a look at? And there's a girl that we follow each other on Instagram, and she said, she works in the herbarium at the New York Botanical Gardens, and said, if you've got time, come and have a look. And that was such a huge honour and a pleasure to go and meet everyone at the Botanical Gardens. It's very similar to Kew, but it's sort of you get to see behind the scenes there. And to hear them talk about the work and the fact, you know, the things that they love about the work, and they know, they kind of know what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to be impressed is a huge honor, that they think that it's good enough that I've impressed them. So it's everybody, the people, you know, there are people that buy the work just because they like the way it's displayed and the subject. And there are other people who are enthusiasts and mushroom enthusiasts, or, you know, there was another lady, one of my customers is the head of bryology at Edinburgh Botanical Gardens. And bryology is a study of liverworts and lichen. And she commissioned me to make a piece for her, which I made. And she very kindly sent me an email saying that she'd shown everyone in her department, and they were, you know, really excited to see it. And they thought it was, you know, the right thing. I'd yeah. done the right thing. So, and that to me is that I've job done. I've done what I set out to do. I have made something that someone can say, yes, you've made a good representation of that species. And, yeah. and that's, you know, incredible. And I'm, you know, going forward in the future, I hope that I will do more of that. I did have someone from the Mycology Society saying, you know, would I do an exhibition, or could I show some of my work there? So all these things are sort of, you know, in the pipeline, as it were.
Well, that's got to be incredibly gratifying. People who know exactly what's right and what isn't, who then look at your work and say, yes, you hit it. That's,
Yeah. And there's always that slight nervous moment when you know who they are. And you think, oh God, are you going to tell me it's wrong?
Yeah. Yeah. How could you possibly do the gills that way? They aren't anything like that. Yeah.
Well, I've got this reference book, which is written by Roger Phillips, who's, you know, he's written what could be described as one of the most comprehensive guides to mushrooms and other fungi. And we're now Instagram friends because he came and he met me at one of the shows that I was doing. He didn't introduce himself, actually. He said he was interested and then looked at the work and said, oh, yes, you know, yes, these are very good. And then he said, I've written a book on mushrooms. And I said, oh, I might know it. What's your name? And he said, oh, it's Roger Phillips. And I sort of like almost fell over. I was like, oh, that's my best book. I'm almost sad that I didn't have it there for him to sign for me. But he sort of said, yes, you're doing well. You're doing the right thing. These are good representations. And I think, well, if it's good enough for Roger Phillips, then it must be all right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. There you have it right there. Well, Amanda. Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been a treat to talk to you. Appreciate the time.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
Yep. And for folks who are listening, I'll put some pictures on the website page for this podcast, but also a link to Amanda's site. And there she has a full gallery of her work. And she'll owe you a couple hours. I'll tell you, you'll sit there just gaping at it. I guarantee you. It's beautiful work all the way around. It really is. Thank you so much, Amanda. Thanks to Sassy Jacks.
Thank you, Gary.